Dear listeners, we are taking a break from our regular programming today to bring you a special episode of the Sandeep Roy Show. In this episode, host Sandeep Roy talks to journalist and author Sugata Srinivasa Raju, who explores the politics of the senior Congress leader Rahul Gandhi in the book Strange Burdens. The conversation is useful to understand the predicaments of Rahul Gandhi, especially against the backdrop of the recently concluded assembly elections where the Congress was defeated in three major states in the Hindi heartland, Rajasthan, Chhattisgarh and Madhya Pradesh. We hope you enjoy the conversation and also check out the other episodes of the Sandeep Roy Show. The link to the entire catalogue is given in the description.
Hello and welcome to the Sandeep Roy Show on Express Audio. In 2014, I was covering the elections in Amethi. Rahul Gandhi was still the MP from Amethi, the family constituency. But I still remember a quote from some youngsters I met on the street. "There's no point in having a girlfriend in Amethi," someone told me. "What's there to do?" The movie hall had been sold off. Watchmen chased them away from the park. They couldn't even think of an air-conditioned store. They had the Sanjay Gandhi Hospital, the Indira Gandhi School of Nursing, the good works of the Rajiv Gandhi Charitable Trust. But they wanted cafe coffee days and parks with benches. Rahul and Priyanka Gandhi came on the campaign trail and drove past in a shower of rose petals waving. A man watching them said, "He's a good man, but all he can do is wave." Most of the young people had affection for Rahul Gandhi, but said he didn't understand they didn't want charity, they wanted jobs, not, as they put it, shikshit berozgari. Meanwhile, Congress workers did roadside theatre reminding people about the sacrifices of the Nehru Gandhis, complete with reenactments of Indira and Rajiv Gandhi's assassinations. This has been the eternal dilemma for Rahul Gandhi. He is the guardian of the Nehru-Gandhi holy flame, but sometimes it seems like his real mission is to reinvent his own party. On the other hand, many supporters of his party feel the real stumbling block to its reinvention is Rahul Gandhi himself, who will neither renounce it nor lead it from the front with gusto. He has been the object of deep sympathy from those who remember the bespectacled young man with the body of his father. And he has been the subject of more stinging memes than most political leaders. Sugata Srinivasa Raju, journalist and author, looks at the politics and predicaments of Rahul Gandhi in the book Strange Burdens and joins us on the show. Sugata Srinivasa Raju, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandeep. Thank you for having me.
One of the oft-repeated lines about Rahul Gandhi is that Narendra Modi and the BJP's biggest electoral asset is Rahul Gandhi. That the BJP needs Pakistan externally and Rahul Gandhi internally. Was that ever accurate and is that still true?
Oh, that's a very interesting question to start with. See, a lot of things are propaganda, as you and I would understand that. The papufication of Rahul Gandhi is propaganda. And also trying to make him look like an electoral liability is also propaganda. Yes, the Congress has underperformed. The Congress has not been able to get things right. But, you know, I think the biggest fear that Modi has is Rahul Gandhi and the Congress party. Not because the family is a great threat electorally, because the infrastructure of the party is spread across India and it's the only brand that is recognized across India. So they try to create these little phrases or little memes, as they would say, or caricature him so that, you know, that brand is diluted. It's not comparable with Pakistan at all. This is a very, very different kind of situation. And they know this. If the Congress party decides tomorrow, they can, you know, pull up their whole thing and then they can start fighting the BJP much better. It's another fact that the Congress has not done that in the last 9.5 years. But the thing is that if the Congress decides to do it, they know it has the greatest recall across India.
It might, but isn't that all part of a sort of glorious past. I mean, we can look at the seat share, obviously, but even its vote share is declining in many states. It's a shadow of its former self. Local parties, many of them offshoots of the Congress, like in Trinamool in West Bengal, where I am, have pretty much taken over that space. So in that sense, I mean, the Congress has done a pretty good job of shooting itself in the foot.
No, you're absolutely right. See, the decline of the Congress vote share started after the Rajiv Gandhi election in 84. You know, I don't think the Congress has been able to hold on. And, 91, after the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi, despite the fact that there was a tragic event, it did not play out like 84. So Narasimha Rao formed a minority government. And ever since, it has been a steady decline. In fact, it has gone under 20% in 2019. There was a small little bump in 2009. But then that was for very different reasons. It was not because the Congress was doing well, but, you know, the economy was doing well. And there was a certain degree of anger against the communist parties because, you know, they were trying to disturb this whole story of Indian economic growth. And also Advani was a jaded figure by then. You know, I mean, he was seen as attacking a very decent man as a weak prime minister and things like that. And in many states, you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, except for a couple of states in the south, that is Kerala and Karnataka, and then of course Madhya Pradesh and Chhattisgarh and all these places, the Congress is a poor shadow of itself. You know, I mean, it was a dominating force, you know, I mean, until the 80s. But from the 90s on, the Congress has had to accommodate other political parties to prop up some kind of a ruling alliance. And you remember the Pachmari Conference of the Congress Party, where they formally accept the coalition era. But the Congress has a dubious record of pulling down secular coalitions. Although they accepted the coalition era, they went about, you know, I mean, disturbing the secular coalitions that were formed. And, you know, my previous book was on Devegowda. So I write quite elaborately as to what happened. And the West Bengal chief minister then, Jyoti Basu, in fact, in his, you know, archival recordings at the Nehru Memorial, NMML, you know, I mean, records it very, very clearly that the Congress comes up with this line saying that, oh, a bahut communal. So he asks for evidence and they're unable to provide any. It's just that they just want him out because they think that this man is capable of finishing the Congress itself. And that is a fear that has haunted the Congress. And that is why I am not greatly hopeful of the India Alliance, because all those people who are now sitting with the Congress trying to dislodge Modi are people who grew at the expense of the Congress. So now, if you are going to have a seat sharing arrangement with all of these people sitting at the table with you, you know, Congress has to give up many seats than it will contest. For example, I think they contested around 424 or 425 seats in 2019, if my memory is correct. And they'll have to come down to 200. And I say 200 because it's Mamata Banerjee who said that Congress should not contest any more than 200 seats. And she said this 8 months ago or a year ago. And Tejaswi Yadav repeated that. He said Congress should not contest more than 200. And that is because it was only in about 199 seats that the Congress had a straight-on fight with the BJP. So now we will, going ahead, see how this whole seat-sharing paradox will be solved, because Congress, they all made space out of Congress. That is the paradox.
But now here's this other paradox. So in that case, when the Congress is doing such a spectacular job in becoming the incredibly shrinking Congress, and its own allies are trying to, you know, cut it down to size, why is it still so important for the BJP to go on about a Congress Mukt India? That in some ways, one would say that a Gandhi Mukt India does not serve the BJP actually, because they need that figure to, as the other.
Yes. No, but the other can, as I told you, I mean, a little while ago, the other is a kind of dinosaurus, or it's a kind that can get up on its feet and start threatening you, because that's the only other national party. Look at the vote shares of the Communist Party of India or the Communist Party of India Marxist. It's under 2%. So they have no national imprint. Mayawati was the only threat, if you look at states and the vote share that she could manage. But there is no other political party which has a kind of a national imprint. That's the reason why the One Nation and all that kind of sloganeering is happening, only because they want to be seen as the only national alternative. And tomorrow, if people say the India Alliance, it's not going to happen. But assume that the India Alliance says that we're all going to contest under one symbol, like it happened in 1977. Let's forget all independent brands and let's contest under one symbol. And that symbol will obviously have to be the hand symbol. It is not going to happen because the other parties are not fools to allow that to happen. But that is the fear. The infrastructure exists. The mind recall exists. And in an age where brands are fungible, you know, you don't know whether you read a particular news item in an X or paper Y.
Or a WhatsApp forward.
Yeah, or WhatsApp forward. Absolutely. I mean, Congress as a brand is still a threat to the BJP. And the BJP, you know, is also on a very, very kind of thin ice. That is because all their glory surrounds one individual, that is Modi. You know, the RSS could not do much until Modi took over the entire machine. So now the obvious question will be what happens after Modi? So, I mean, even in that sense, waiting out will help the Congress. Even if, say, they don't make it in 24, it's still a potential thing. In my book launch in Delhi, Prithviraj Chauhan made this point. Whether we like it or not, Rahul Gandhi is going to sort of control Indian politics or going to be extremely important, not control, extremely important in Indian politics for the next 25 years, whether I am going to be there or not. And this waiting out game is something that the Congress has played well. It could be a sloppiness, slothiness, or some kind of insolent whatever thing. But then Congress has always waited out. And they think that that is the default that setting of this nation. And that is arrogance too. I write about it in my book that, you know, I mean, what Rahul Gandhi is trying to do is not exactly making a progressive case for Indian social democracy, but he's arguing on a certain kind of restoration process. He's trying to build a utopia where he's trying to tell you everything was fine 10 years ago. We were flourishing economically. India was absolutely secular. There were social harmony. There was no crime happening. We were all good. So let's restore that. Which is not exactly correct. We know it is a kind of a new branding exercise that they have indulged in. So I argue in the book that this argument of restoration is not the greatest of arguments that a liberal or a Democrat should make. We should only argue for a larger expansion of the social democratic space. I mean, the interesting thing, Sandeep, is that no political party after independence has got more than 50% vote share, including Nehru, including Rajiv, who got the biggest mandate. They did not touch 50%. So then what kind of democracy are we speaking? You know, 50 plus 1 is the clear majority that anybody would speak of. You look at a lot of European countries. There are runoffs to get 51%. We saw an election in France. We see elections in Germany, and they take 3-4 months to form a government. So, but here it does not happen because you are first past the post system. And even, I mean, you have formed national governments with 19 MPs, you know, I mean, propping up a prime ministerial candidate. That's Devegowda. It speaks greatly about the Indian diversity. I also sort of ponder in the book if we should be a permanent coalition to represent the ethnic diversity, linguistic diversity, cultural diversity, all of that. But that argument the Congress won't buy. Because the moment you make that argument, the Congress loses out. It can only lead a coalition, but it cannot form a government on its own. So they don't want to rule out that possibility. But that's a grand possibility, which is something which this country probably deserves with the kind of diversity.
Well, let me interrupt you there, Sugata, and say at a time when the national sort of push is towards one of everything, one nation, one this, one that. Can you actually make a passionate case for diversity?
Well, that is the only possible alternative, even as of today. So you may call it the India Alliance. You may call it some other alliance. You know, Devegowda was trying to float a Janata Federal Front. Whatever alliance you call it, you know, you have to put together vote shares and seats to form a government. And I think there was a survey in a national magazine recently which said NDA's collective vote share is X. And UPA, I mean, the India Alliance's vote share is X. And the vote share was higher. So they were trying to say or trying to build this narrative that we have a greater vote share and they have a lesser vote share. And even that greater vote share was not touching 50%. So there has to be some kind of a conscious effort to bring about that kind of a 51%. Modi's vote share is 36-37% now. So it's far lesser than what a Rajiv Gandhi got or a Nehru got or a Indira Gandhi got. So it's quite funny that such a big nation has not sorted out its electoral game There's another problem with public intellectuals here. There is a strong affiliation to either that side or this side. They also run the binary game. Nobody is thinking in terms of accommodation. The Congress is as much guilty of playing the binary game as much as the BJP. And the Congress says, if you're not with me, you're not a liberal. You're not secular. And people like us also are seen with great suspicion. They don't know whether we are trying to speak for them or against them.
I don't think this book has helped you in that dilemma.
No, not at all. You know, not at all. Not at all. Although all the arguments are enlightenment arguments. No, reason, social justice, representation of diversity. It's stuck somewhere in the middle, in the throat. They can't digest it, they can't spit it out. You know, that's the kind of feeling that I get even looking at the reviews.
When you speak of the binary, if Rahul is the BJP's other,
yes,
and the other is a very valuable thing politically to rally the troops, what should Rahul's other be? I mean, some would say he's made RSS the other. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Yes. No, no, that's very, very interesting and important question. You know why? If Rahul had made BJP the other, I think he would have electorally done better. I wouldn't say he would have succeeded. But what Rahul Gandhi ends up doing is that he makes the Savarkarite his other, the RSS the other. So he is trying to make the Congress the ideological opposite of the RSS, not exactly the BJP. So there is a huge difference in terms of the way you think when you want to make a political party an ideological machine or a cadre-based party, and you're trying to counter the Savarkarite arguments and the RSS and not exactly the BJP. See, the criticism of the BJP that happens in the Congress is actually very, very little and very nominal. So it sort of gets limited to some policy thing or something else. They are never seen attacking the policy thing as much as they are attacking the ideological moorings of the BJP. And Rahul Gandhi wants to become the secular moral compass of this country. But if you are trying to be that, then you should clearly say that you're not interested in executive power. That he's not openly saying, or he's not being allowed to say that.
So are you saying, in a certain sense, to use very large metaphors here, Rahul Gandhi would like to be a Mahatma Gandhi figure, but his party keeps making him the Nehru?
Yeah, I mean, that is because the party is also in such a dire strait. They also don't know if they try to get somebody else outside the Nehru family, if the party will stick together. But I think that Rahul Gandhi's, given the kind of ambivalence that he has towards power, he should be more a Mahatma Gandhi kind of figure. Now, I mean, it's a large metaphor. He can't be a Mahatma Gandhi. We know that. Let me qualify that. See, Gandhi built a culture machine for the Congress Party. Gandhi built a cultural argument as to why the Congress Party should exist. And before Gandhi, the Congress was Lytton's Liberals. It was a group of English Anglophone intellectuals trying and a debating society that has been recorded pretty well. But Gandhi moves it to the middle of people and makes it a mass party. And every single action of Gandhi was not political but cultural. It could be the salt satyagraha. It could be the whole idea of having a prayer in the evening. You know, fasting. The whole idea of fasting comes from the Hindu thing. Calling himself a Sanatani, which has become a very, very bad word these days. See, everything was cultural. Then what happens is that Gandhi is gone and there is Nehru. And Nehru and Patel and Azad and all those who held the levers of power in post-independent India initially were people who were working under the air cover that Gandhi had provided, that is the cultural air cover, and that sustained them for a few decades. But you started seeing that resistance to Nehru very early, you know, around 58, 59, you start seeing a lot of literature which starts criticizing the Nehruvian reason in many, many ways. And Nehru sort of gets into planning and a lot of things. And Nehru also had a good reason to do that. He needed to take the nation out of the kind of partition trauma that had existed. India had seen a lot of bloodshed. So Nehru had a good reason to do it, although I don't know if he did it consciously, but he sort of shifted the attention. But then that did not sustain for long. And if you notice, the last phase of Indira Gandhi was a very Hindutvaized phase of Indira Gandhi. And Rajiv Gandhi, Rahul Gandhi's father, continues with that. That engagement and that association with something radically Hindu does not discontinue with him. So he's trying to please the extreme Islamic thought process as well as the extreme right thought process.
When you mentioned the last phase of Indira Gandhi being very sort of Hindutvaized,
yes.
I couldn't help but remember this thing which you quote in the book. And I'll give the quote out without telling the listener who is saying this. Somebody is talking about Indira Gandhi in an interview with the New York Times in 1984. And you write in the book, it's saying, Mrs. Gandhi is playing a very dangerous game. The long-term interests of the country are being sacrificed to short-term gains. But encouraging Hindu chauvinism is not going to pay. As the majority community, the Hindus must be above parochial politics. I'll let you tell the listeners who is the person who's talking about Mrs. Gandhi.
No, I'll let you tell them.
That is, you know, if you put in a Mr. Modi instead of Mrs. Gandhi, it could be Rahul Gandhi talking
yes.
about Mr. Modi to the New York Times. But in fact, this is Atal Bihari Vajpayee
Absolutely.
Talking about Mrs. Gandhi.
That is the most shocking bit. In fact, I also corroborate that with Vajpayee was out of favor at that time with the RSS. And this is something that you find in this fascinating book by A.G. Noorani, which is, you know, I mean, looking at what really disturbed the kind of equanimity that existed at that point of time, which completely went right afterwards. And the situation did not help when P.V. Narasimha Rao came. So in fact, recently there was this controversy when Manishankaraya said he was the first BJP prime minister. Things ever since has been a kind of downward slide. And even Rahul Gandhi, let us be very, very sure, 16, 17, 18, he was caught in a kind of Hindutva hierarchical game where he was trying to say, I am a Brahmin, I am a Kaul from Kashmir. Although he cannot claim that ancestry so clearly for the simple reason that, you know, I mean, his father, grandfather was a Parsi, his, you know, mother is Italian. So that is being made capital by the BJP. It's unfair.
And also to go back to the earlier point, it also shows how much the needle has moved where, you know, at one time you might have been able to actually make that an asset. Look at me. I am the unity in diversity
yes.
in India.
Yes.
You know, I am proof that all of this can coexist in India as opposed to the push now to be purely one thing or the other.
I'm surprised that Rahul Gandhi never claimed his mixed ancestry as a strength. He has never made a statement on that. He has always tried to sort of, you know, I mean, go past it. And I don't know why. And he's also never ever subjected Indira Gandhi, the dadi he loved so much, and his father to any kind of critical scrutiny.
But is that unfair to expect of him, you know?
It's not unfair.
I mean, as people sitting now, even people who may be supporting the Congress party, they can go back and sort of critique the record and say, yes, that was a mistake, that, you know, the party shouldn't have done this. Because they are sort of safely away from that. You know, they were not the people taking decisions then. And while Rahul cannot be held accountable for actions that his grandmother did, it is a bloodline. It is hard to speak against the dadi.
Correct. But you're a fifth generation dynast. You are sitting in that chair only because you happen to come from that bloodline. It has a strategic value electorally to say a few things were done wrong by my father as well and my grandmother as well. But I am a different individual. He has actually said that in a softer way, but never taking their names. He has asked him to be judged for what he is rather than what where he belongs or comes from. But then, you know, I mean, that kind of subtlety is never picked up by the masses. If Modi is saying Congress Mukt Bharat, Modi also qualifies that. He says all the wrong things of the Congress party. And they always hold you liable for 1984 and other riots and then as well as, you know, I mean, Babri Masjid and then emergency, a lot of other things. See, I'm talking from the point of view of the fact that Rahul Gandhi is trying to completely reconfigure the Congress party. If you're trying to reconfigure, there cannot be a small emotional component, which is a holy cow. You cannot say, no, this is something that we will not touch, but I will change everything else. I completely agree with you when you say he was not party to all those decisions that were taken then. The new Labour under Tony Blair, you know, I mean, it moved right. That's a separate thing. But there was a lovely headline given in the New Yorker then in this letter from London that Julian Barnes used to write. Then the headline itself was left, right, here comes Tony Blair. These things have happened with other political parties in other parts of the world. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, speculate if this emotional component is also handled well, it may sort of play a completely different thing. See, he's trying to borrow the agenda of the Mandal parties and try to make it that of the Congress party. So he's flexible everywhere. But why not here? And also, when it comes to the ideological preceptor of the Congress party, the way Rahul Gandhi is projecting the ideological preceptor, it is Nehru. He is not talking about Indira. He has never spoken about his father that way. And that's the reason why Nehru is also being targeted by the BJP. So I don't know whether Rahul Gandhi picked on Nehru and therefore they targeted, or the BJP, you know, started targeting Nehru downwards. And I also told you about how for him it's a restoration project, and any restoration project is a conservative project. So he is trying to do that, and I wish he sort of looked ahead. And even with the Mandal thing that is happening now, where he is trying to say that caste census hona chahiye, and he is saying, you know, I mean, caste has to be done in certain way and that has to be accommodated. You know, basically he is trying to be accommodative and trying to, you know, I mean, throw something else at Modi when, you know, I mean, he is trying to speak of one India, trying to obliterate all the multitudes and layers that India is, the diversity that India is. So he is probably looking at it as a opposite of that. And it is not with conviction that he is embracing the opposite. The opposite can also be your same secular, non-whatever caste thing as well. But you have to have a different kind of imagination to build that alternative, and it will take time. It cannot be done for 2024. So probably this is a shortcut. But this shortcut can either become a huge liability for the simple reason that the Mandal parties know how to play it extremely well. In the Indian Express, Devegowda gave an interview, and there is one point that he makes at the end, which I thought was brilliant, where he says, now Congress is trying to take over the Mandal agenda. So is it trying to finish all the Mandal parties? No, it can work both ways. You can be accommodative of them, or you could take over their agenda and finish them.
Yeah, swallow them up.
Swallow them up. So that was the sharpest comment that I've heard.
What is also very interesting to me is this point that you make that the Congress party was sort of this elitist debating society until a Mahatma Gandhi was far more rooted
yes.
in sort of the cultural milieu of the ethos of the country, came and gave it that kind of cultural cover. So in this project of trying to rejuvenate the Congress party, I would say, argue based on what you're saying, is that basically an Anglophone liberal like Rahul Gandhi is not really cut out for the job. What you need is what you talk about in the book as the regional liberal who gets very short shrift in our sort of Delhi Latian space.
No, Rahul Gandhi is certainly not a rooted cosmopolitan. He is a cosmopolitan, but I would have expected him to be a rootedly cosmopolitan person, which he cannot be at this stage of his life. That is for sure. So the kind of strategies that he's trying to build is also therefore not very convincing. You know, it is short term. You know, he's trying to borrow here, borrow there, try to put it together and try to be more accommodative. And also, if you look at all the recent things that he has been doing, including gifting Noori to Mrs. Gandhi, you know, the video that has been doing around. So he is clearly looking at the percentage.
This is a little Jack Russell Terrier.
Yes.
Though I have to say, Sugata, when I saw that video and I thought a smarter person would have given his mother a stray indie dog, an elite Jack Russell Terrier.
No, I had the same thought crossing my mind, a mongrel or some kind of, you know, I mean, in our part of the world, there are these hounds, which are local breeds. Those would have sort of probably made a better gift. But anyway, the whole thing there is, the way I look at it also is that he has now become extremely conscious of a certain data point that must have been fed to him, which is more than 60-65% of India is below a certain age. You look at him, he has never worn a kurta pajama after a point of time. I mean, this suggestion 10 years ago, I had written somewhere in, I think, Outlook or wherever, where I said a ribbed t-shirt looks good on him because he has a muzzle to show. And this was before the Congress came into a crisis. But now he has made that his uniform. He has made a white t-shirt his uniform. And it's not the white kurta. There must be some smart aleck who's trying to advise him on the demographic preferences and passion. But it is still not cultural. The cultural is a completely different game. So cultural is today, you know, I mean, if you go to any temple or any IT place, and I come from Bangalore, you know, if you look at any IT professional, the endogamous marriage is thriving in that industry. It's not that they are trying to embrace variety because they go to Germany or America. It's not that. The technocratic mindset is not a mindset that is equivalent to a mindset with a scientific temper or a rational whatever thing. They're two different things. And I think those things are very, very deep. And playing with religion and playing with caste without fully understanding it can create problems. So it's better that you do things which try to not obliterate it, but be accommodative of it. But, you know, you should allow others to sort of front it. You can't do everything. For example, you have a Karge there. But what is Karge speaking? Karge is just going around the country, you know, I mean, following him. And I mean, the appointments or whatever it is, you're not making use of, he's a figurehead. The Dalit is a figurehead. So you've not changed those things.
What you're saying is that Rahul is fighting BJP's emotional and religious cultural nationalism with the wrong set of tools. You know, you're trying to fact check things. You're trying to scientifically debunk or poke a hole in saying, no, this fact was wrong. Why does that not work?
No, it doesn't work because, you know, I mean, the cultural has no reason or rationale. It is a set of things that you have inherited. See, I mean, we called Rahul Gandhi a dynast, right? But that is a bloodline kind of an argument. But there is a certain kind of cultural dynasty that works in India, and that comes through caste. Rahul Gandhi should have made the argument of cultural dynasties in India, but he cannot make that argument as well because he comes from the upper echelons of caste. And he has claimed that as well. In fact, when I wrote for Karge becoming president of the Congress party, I think the Shashi Tharoor camp was very upset about it. But just imagine a Shashi Tharoor plus Rahul Gandhi. It would be two cosmopolitan figures there, and your whole thing, even notionally, would be extremely bad. But they didn't seem to understand. They thought being articulate is important, to fact check is important. And more you ridicule the accent of Modi, his dressing sense, or the way he walks in with an imperial gait, the more and more you're alienating a larger audience, because the larger audience sees Modi as an extension of themselves, quote unquote, a tea seller who went and sat there and is showing it to these fellows that he can run this country as well as a Nehru or an Indira Gandhi. See, Devegowda, the subject of my previous book, for he may not have been celebrated in Delhi, but if you go to the Northeast today, if you go to Kashmir today, the remote parts of India, he was seen as a great symbol of democracy because someone who was a nobody became the prime minister of this country. And if the Congress party is speaking about democracy, they should celebrate that. And they don't. So all the figures like Sardar Patel was a figure like a Devegowda in a much, much bigger sense, right? He was rustic, direct, you know what I mean? Not like Nehru, sophisticated or whatever. But that figure was completely forgotten until the BJP appropriated and built the biggest statue in the world. And Azad was forgotten. Lal Bahadur Shastri was forgotten. P.V. Narasimha Rao, the most recent thing. They do it in a very spiteful way. They credit Manmohan Singh, but they don't want to credit P.V. Narasimha Rao. Let me tell you, in a cabinet system, if the prime minister does not want something, nothing can pass through the cabinet. So if Narasimha Rao did not want India to be liberalized, Manmohan Singh had to take a walk. And Manmohan Singh tries to resign. You know, I mean, this has been documented well. And he says, I'll give you the political cover. Don't worry, go ahead and do it. We need this at this point of time. So there are a lot of such things which the Congress looks away and now is trying to desperately recover. And even on the names, the Nehru Memorial Library, which has become the Pradhan Mantri Sangrahalaya, the Congress put up a resistance, and anybody with the right sense wouldn't have. Because if it's being given a genric name, why should you have any objection? And again, the Devegowda stepped in and he said, I am happy. Nobody remembered me. He's remembering me. So, you know, it's funny, actually, the way the Congress contradicts itself, tries to be the most democratic, but then ends up being very, very loyal to the family.
You have a great line in the book where when you talk about Modi's imperial gait, you have this weird situation in India today where you have the prince, the fifth generation dynast, the prince who wants to be a commoner, and then the commoner who gets to walk with the imperial gait. And it's no surprise that, I mean, which is more aspirational for an ordinary voter? There's no contest here.
No, you got the absolutely right thing. See, the whole aspirational element is expressed by Modi better. And look at what the Congress has done in the last 3 years or 4 years. Everything that they have raised has, quote unquote, a negative connotation. I'm not trying to say there has been no fault, but in terms of narrative, you know, I mean, you don't go to the GST midnight session. You don't go to the new parliament. You don't go to the Independence Day celebration. You even have a problem with a tribal being elected. And then you say the tribal president has not been invited to the new parliament. You know, you are contradicting yourself. And this whole thing about Rahul Gandhi playing down his aristocratic background and Modi behaving the other way. See, India, all said and done, is a very feudal country. The people don't want the Raja to be very accessible. So your Bharat Jodo Yatra frames were accessible frames. You know, people were crowding into your frame. And Modi loves to be alone in a frame. And that is the Raja frame. If you go to any palace in India, the Raja is standing and he has been painted alone. It's not with his subjects. Either he's in his regalia, or he's doing a darbar, or he's sitting on an elephant. And Modi knows that this country's cultural mindset has not altered too much. And Modi plays on poverty and this cultural poverty with a certain way. And Rahul Gandhi looks at real poverty in a certain way. Rahul Gandhi does not understand the cultural poverty. Modi understands it brilliantly. And Rahul Gandhi looks at poverty in a very literal sense. Therefore, he wants to sort of, you know, lift them. He's talking of economic solutions. And Modi is all the time giving cultural solutions. It's a civilizational glory that he's trying to say, we have always been great. It's a Trumpian kind of nonsense. But still, it works. Look at what's happening in America now. Let's make America great again is happening here. Let's make India great again. So the civilizational is being countered with the economic argument, and that is not working. And people thought that they have been insulted for long enough, not just by the British, but also by the Congress upper crust, and they have to hit back. And to support that argument, you know, very, very paradoxically, is all the regional parties and all the regional party chiefs who are saying, Mamata cannot say that the Congress treated me very well, but I still walked out. Sharad Pawar does not say that the Congress really was great to me, but I still had to walk out. Devegowda was denied a Congress ticket in 62, and therefore he, you know, contested as an independent. So everybody who has moved out from the Congress frame also has a problem with the Congress, and the Savarkarite also has a problem with the Congress.
So what is a fifth generation dynast to do? I mean, does Rahul Gandhi have to become a Prince Harry?
I do make a reference to Prince Harry, but he's a far more sincere and, you know, I mean, a far more empathetic, compassionate thing in our context. Now, completely different. I don't think we can make a direct comparison with Harry. He's struggling with a lot of things. The one big thing that can get solved right away, and people will not really, you know, scrutinize him as much as they do now, if he says, I will never be the prime minister of this country. If he says that, you know, people like Ramchandra Guha have said it in a very harsh way. You know, they have said that this fellow is blocking everything. But I would like to put it in a positive way. I would like to say that he has to embrace the trusteeship idea of Mahatma Gandhi and has to become the real custodian of the values and traditions of the Congress party, and then say that this pool, there's going to be a new Congress where the top chair is open for anybody. So you cannot be a Mahatma Gandhi, but at least strategically, you open up this space so the place becomes more democratic and nobody can say Congress Mukt Bharat because everybody else is trying to vie for a place in the Congress party.
Following up on that point, Sugata, that is sort of what the Bharat Jodo Yatra was supposed to be, because the Congress went out of its way to say this was not about projecting Rahul as the prime ministerial candidate. This is not an electoral thing. Do you think it achieved some of that for the Congress?
No, it did achieve a lot. We should sort of accept it did achieve a lot because it gave Rahul Gandhi for the first time an experience directly with the people of India from the south to the north. But as you again said, the messaging for the first half of the Yatra, that is until it crossed the Vindhyas, was what you said. That is, he does not a yatra for this or that to gain power, or we are not chasing power. We are only doing this to unite India. We are trying to demonstrate that this is one country. It was a very beautiful kind of line which had to be built up as you progress to the north. But Rahul Gandhi himself destroyed that line because he suddenly became a Shiv Bhakt after he reached Madhya Pradesh. The messaging became very complicated after that. And by the time he reached Kashmir, he had come back to square one, where, you know, one expected him to speak with a great deal of insight about having met people, having seen the variety that is India, the geographical, the linguistic, the demographic variety of India. But what does he end up doing in Srinagar on the final day? He speaks about his trauma. He speaks about having lost his father. So he comes back to the theme that I start the book with. I thought it would end differently. So he's a very spontaneous person. He's a very honest person, very sincere. I don't distrust him for a single minute. But I think if you're talking politics, and we are talking politics because it's one of the largest political parties that you're leading. So if you're talking politics, then you better be prepared and allow your message to be consistent. And you only go on adding to that single big message rather than keep breaking that message like a deconstructionist every 10 yards. No, that is the problem. That is the problem.
Of course, I mean, the trauma is real. I mean, this is a family that has seen more trauma than is should be the share of any family. And it is, I mean, I don't know how you even process the fact that these bodyguards who were teaching you to play badminton and playing badminton with you are the ones who then go and pump bullets into your grandmother. There is no easy way for him to come out of the maze of that trauma. But at the same time, after a while, it feels like that you're just trying to cash in on the trauma also, that you're constantly making that not just your trauma, but a national trauma.
We can accuse him of a lot of things, but not this thing. I've tried to look at it very closely, looked at every single speech that he has made, but he has never tried to cash in because the language of cashing in or trying to play victim is very different. And Rahul Gandhi, to be fair to him, absolutely fair to him, has not done that. He has never exploited that. Perhaps he would have been a little more successful had he sort of built in that language effectively, which he has not, I think. But each one reconciles with their trauma in a different way. We can't expect him to reconcile with it like the way his mother reconciled. I think she had a better reconciliation process, but we don't know what that better is because it's not in the public domain. And we know his sister probably handled it differently. We don't know. You know, I mean, it's unfair to say anything. And the processing of trauma by one person is not exactly that should be the process of another person. So he deserves to be looked at very, very kindly there. But the thing is, you know, I mean, in the Bangalore launch of my book, where Professor Devi launched the book, there was another speaker called Mr. Chiranjeev Singh, who was the chief secretary of the state and also India's ambassador to the UNESCO some time ago. And he came from Pakistan to India during the emergency. And he was speaking about how people in his family saw a lot of trauma. And there was one particular figure who had killed 9 women members of his family just to ensure that they are not raped or dishonored. And he said that person moved on. But I don't know if he was trying to say that Rahul Gandhi should also move on. You know, I wouldn't recommend that because I don't think that it's one situation has to be replicated elsewhere. But what haunts Rahul Gandhi, according to me, I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist or psychoanalyst, but what I think haunts Rahul Gandhi, which I do mention in the book, is that there is enormous guilt that he trusted the wrong people to play with. And there was another person whom I met in a train once, and he had read a recent piece that I'd written on Rahul Gandhi, and he got talking and he said, no, this man's deepest ambition is very subversive. He wants to blow up his entire legacy and therefore he does all that he does.
But it is a fact that despite everything that has happened to that family, it's quite interesting how Mr. Modi is able to capture the mantle of victimhood so much better than a Rahul Gandhi. Even when, you know, Rahul Gandhi is being disqualified, the defamation suit, you're being given the maximum punishment. But Mr. Modi is much more adroit in able to make himself the victim.
You're bang on. He's able to do that, Sandeep, for the simple reason he is not speaking about his own victimhood. He's speaking about an entire civilization's victimhood, an entire culture's victimhood. So he's able to build it around larger things. So people say, "Ye to fakir aadmi hai," the way he described himself. He is doing it for us. He is doing it for the Hindu religion. He is doing it for our civilization, the Hindu civilization. That reasoning, it may be sophistry. It is sophistry. For all we know, it is sophistry. But it has been injected so well. And you know, I mean, they've used technology to inject it. See, they adopted technology to spread a message. But the Congress has adopted technology for the sake of technology. They have no message. So even if you want to spread a viral thing, what is it that you're going to spread? You are going to spread a fact check? But can you fact check the Babri Masjid? Can you fact check Ayodhya as being Ram Janambhoomi? So that's a matter of faith. So Mr. Gandhi plays it in a different way. And Modi tries to, you know, I mean, plays on these issues of faith and says that we are victims of A, B and C. And the Congress has still not come up with an argument to shake that off. And it's a very difficult argument to shake off.
And what is also very difficult to shake off, in my opinion, Sugata, is that once, thanks to technology, WhatsApp forwards, whatever it is, once a negative perception is built about somebody, it's very hard to switch it around in people's head. A positive perception can become negative very quickly. But even now, you know, like in my school WhatsApp group, you constantly get these sort of pappu memes and forwards. And I am thinking, like, forget the politics. Isn't this whole joke getting a little old by now? But once it's there, it's very hard to unpapuize it.
Yeah, absolutely. See, even yesterday at the airport, I was coming back to Bangalore and somebody was browsing through my book and I was very curious. You know, as an author, I was very curious. So I said, are you going to pick up this book? You know, I mean, not identifying myself. I'm glad that he did not see the last page. He said, well, I mean, somebody has wasted time to write this book. This fellow, inka upar kya kitab likhenge? It was shocking, but I could get exactly where he was coming from.
Did you get that same reaction for Deve Gowda book?
Oh, yes. Deve Gowda's thing was a completely different thing.
Class. It was a class thing.
It was a class and a caste thing because he was a Shudra. But there were pockets in India for Deve Gowda where he was celebrated, like Kashmir. Farooq Abdullah came to my book launch and he cried. He said, until I am alive, until Kashmir, Leh, Ladakh is alive, we'll be indebted to you, Prime Minister. Because when we were down, you were the only one who came four times and tried to do good. You restarted the electoral process in Kashmir. It had been suspended for a long time. Farooq had gone away to London. He brought him back, gave him money, asked him to contest and restarted the whole democratic process. Similarly, in Bangladesh, people, I went there and people said, you people are absolute unfaithful. You know, you don't know how to treat this great man. He gave us water and you defeat him. This was after the 2019 election. You defeat him, you should never put up a candidate against such a great man. So he had pockets of support. But Rahul Gandhi...
What else? He has living rooms of support.
Yeah, he has living rooms. that's so well put. He has living rooms of support. So people may have come to agree or accept that he's not a bad person. But when it comes to running a country, they may say, "Arey yaar, but still, he's a good fellow." That much of concession has been given to him now after 10 years. But I don't think he can run a country. Dekho wo kya kya karte hai. Why should he go to a cobbler's shop? Why should he go to a carpentry? Why should he go to a bike mechanic shop? These are the questions that are being asked. But, and you know, I mean, Rahul Gandhi thinks that he is getting closer to the people. But then the logic works differently there. If you go to them and sit in their mechanic shop, the bike mechanic shop, and do something there, they think that, hey, hum jaisa hai. But Modi never does that. Modi comes from there, but he never goes back there. It's a very complicated thing, you know.
But to me, reading the book, I felt, Sugata, that this is the dilemma. Because of the family dynasty, Rahul Gandhi cannot appear to be hungry for power, hungry for the top job. But if you're not hungry for power, if you're not explicit about wanting that job, it then sounds like you're just waiting for it to be offered to you on a platter, which then becomes a form of entitlement.
That's exactly what I told you. He should make it extremely, really clear that he is not looking for an executive role. He should make this announcement in front of the people saying that I don't want the prime minister says I'll never be prime minister, but I will ensure that the Congress party comes back to power. Then it becomes easy.
But what do you think is stopping him? Himself or his party?
Good question. I think there is probably this fear that once you say that, the party may disintegrate. There is that fear, but that's a risk. Of course, that's a very, very big risk. But then you are caught between a hard place and a rock. You know, I mean, you don't know what to do. So you have to do something drastic. The sacrifice thing, quote unquote, the sacrifice thing has a great deal of appeal in the Indian consciousness.
Even Sonia Gandhi did it.
Yeah. Although, you know, I mean, internally politicians will tell you that it was not exactly planned that way. But the appeal of sacrifice is far greater than the claim of the chair. That is, in between there lies the solution.
You've met him a couple of times, as you write in the book. In person, how did he come across to you?
Very good. He's a very extraordinarily good host. He was very courteous. He ensured that I was made comfortable. And then, you know, I mean, he asked me a few questions. He wanted to know where I come from. It was extremely good. I've never had a meeting like that with a top politician. Because, you know, I mean, he was extremely kind and he came across, his body language was, you know, I mean, very accommodative, inclusive. A wonderful meeting. Those two meetings were wonderful. The outcomes of that intellectually were, you know, I mean, I still can't make out what came out of it. But in terms of being a person, I give him full marks. I've met a lot of leaders, traveled with all of them, but I've never felt this kind of a thing with anybody. You know, Rahul Gandhi is that way very, very special. I should say that. But, you know, I mean, his inability to focus on one thing and take it forward is something that has surprised me always. I thought at times that things are really moving in his favor. But then suddenly he sort of subverts it. You know, I mean, even if he succeeds in 2024, the larger arguments that have been injected into the Indian polity are not going to go away. They'll probably become more starker and harsher. So what they have done, the biggest mistake, is allowing this kind of arguments and sophistry and radicalness about religion and dharma to become mainstream. Because it has become mainstream, it's going to take another 20, 30 years for it to taper off. Until then, we have to fight with it. And he has to fight with it.
Well, we'll see what happens in 2024. Sugata Srinivasa Raju, thank you so much for joining us to talk about the strange burdens of Rahul Gandhi.
Thank you, Sandeep. I greatly enjoyed talking to you. Thank you very much.
Sugata Srinivasa Raju has been a fellow of the Aspen Institute in the US and is currently a Homi Bhabha Fellow. Veteran journalist and columnist from print, television and digital, his previous book was Furrows in the Field, about former Prime Minister H.D. Devegowda. His latest book is Strange Burdens, The Politics and Predicaments of Rahul Gandhi. Send us your thoughts and predicaments wherever you get your podcasts from. Find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at Express Podcasts. Thanks as always for listening. This show was produced by Shashank Bhargav and edited and mixed by Suresh Pawar. This is Sandeep Roy on Express Audio.